Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. If you got our promotion, you know already what this show is going to be about. And for those of you who didn't, it's going to be a conversation with some of the founders of the United Opt-Out movement. And we're going to talk about that movement itself, what it is, how it came about, and we're also going to talk about their book that they just put out this year, an activist handbook for the education revolution, United Opt-Out's Test of Courage. Also, we're going to talk about their upcoming conference that will be in February of next year, and we're going to get to know the founders as individual and a lot of other things. So with that said, let me bring in the three people that we have for this show, Peggy Robinson and Rose Marie Jensen. And we're trying to get Seresta Smith. So Seresta, if you are listening to this show, we had trouble getting you. And you can call us. So let me start by saying Peggy Robinson. Peggy's been on the show, this would be, what, five times today?
Sorry. I think so. Somewhere around there.
I'm going to start charging you rent, Peggy. Hey, you know, I got to pay the bills, so you've been on here enough there that you can, you know, do it too. Most of you know Peggy. Peggy, do a brief intro of yourself.
Sure. As you said, I'm one of the founders of United Opt Out. I'm in my 19th year of teaching, and I live in Denver, Colorado, and I teach at an elementary school in Aurora, Colorado.
And? Any more?
There's a lot more, Peggy.
Yeah, now I'm going to be brief.
Now she's going to be brief and modest and shy, and that's not Peggy, folks. Let me tell you, okay? Rose Marie?
Yes.
Let me stop you, Rose. Okay. This is her first time on the show.
It is.
So let's give a longer intro.
Okay. I obviously am not one of the original founders, but I found Opt Out. I went to their first action in D.C. As a result of the SOS march, actually, and I became connected with them and became very passionate about opting out my own children. But my background is this: I was a teacher. I taught for 10 years in Alachua County in Florida, and also in Broward County, where I did grow up. I ended teaching when I had my children, and since then I've been very active in, obviously, PTA, SAC and staff meetings, ESC advisory councils, those kinds of things. So I've been an activist kind of on the other side. It kind of became for me when my daughter started kindergarten. She ended up going to the school where many of my colleagues were teaching, and it became very clear to me that they didn't have a voice. And they were coming to me quietly and saying, could you bring this up at SAC? Could you let the school board know? Could you, you know, about many practices and things that they were experienced were too afraid to speak out on? So I found that I had a lot more power and that I couldn't get fired for speaking out on behalf of teachers. And, of course, you know, those their conditions are were my kids' conditions. So it was very important for me to do that. So I've kind of found that I have a little bit more power on this side than I did while I was teaching, although I was quite the rabble rouser when I was teaching too. So, so my certificate is still current. I just renewed it. I'm not sure why, but I'm still very active in education. You know, and I at this point I thought I'd be back in kindergarten teaching kindergarten. I really did, but circumstances are that I don't think I could live within the confines that are expected. And I give great props to my friends and Peggy and everybody who is still, you know, fighting the fight within these constraints. But I have a son who is ESE, and it requires a lot of fight on my part on his behalf. So there you go.
Wow. See, I didn't know that. So that's good for me to know. I'm sure others as well. Movement. I said, I'm sure it's good for me to know as well as others.
Yeah.
The movement. Let's start with how it got started. Peggy, you mentioned in your intro to the book that you guys were not the first kids on the block. It was there previously. Can we talk about that some? The history of it, more or less.
Sure. In the intro I say that because I always want to make it clear that, you know, we're not the first people to consider opting out. But I do think we were the first group to really think through the end goal and the bigger picture of how we might, you know, make it go national in a way that pulled people together really, really quickly. And it really just started with me emailing Morna McDermott McNulty. I emailed her on an educational listserv throwing out this idea I had of creating a Facebook group where we had a file for every state, therefore that the goal would be that it would be an opt-out guide for every state, and that we would begin to mobilize people to opt out nationwide in an effort to deny them the data and stop the profit and reclaim our public schools. So I threw this out on an email to a listserv, said, hey, does anybody want to join me in starting this Facebook group page? And Morna's the only one that wrote me back. So it was the two of us that got going on that, and then the other four joined us very quickly just via social media. And, you know, once you start talking opt-out, people talk to one another, and we all began to locate each other. So then there were six of us, and literally within 48 hours, we could not keep up with the request to support parents and students in opting out across the country. It went like wildfire, and it hasn't stopped. You know, we're year five, and we just keep growing, and it just keeps getting bigger. And, you know, I think the other piece of what we do, the reason why it has done so well is because this isn't top-down. This is grassroots. So while we provided a base for opt-out, we gave people the support, and then we said, you know, go for it, and let us know how we can help you. We don't have a Facebook page for every state. We have our base page, and then everybody else has gone out and created their own based on what they needed in their communities. And I think that's the reason this has done so well, is because there's been no top-down management to squelch the creativity and the voices and the needs of people across the country, because every state, every city, every district, they all have different needs in regard to opt-out. That's pretty much how it got started.
That's how United Opt Out got started. But before United Opt Out, was there other efforts? Or let me put it another way. The legal precedent for being able to opt out, do you know that history?
I don't know. I don't think I could really speak to that. I know that before us, there were people opting out. I know that here in Colorado, we had a teacher that refused to administer the test way before United Opt Out started. In terms of the legal precedent, yeah, I don't know that I could speak much to that.
Well, not so much the legal precedent. In what legislation that says that we're going to, you know, the test movement started, the high-stake test movement started and was ramped up with No Child Left Behind.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 01-02.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any law on the books, federal books, or even state books, that says that high-stakes testing or our state-level testing is something that parents have the right to opt out? Because what I'm getting at is a conversation we had some time ago when you said that when you met Seresta, I think it was at a Save Our School event, and you learned from her that she had opted her children out or child out.
Right.
And from there, you and she got together the idea and it went forward from that. So for her to have opted her children out before the two of you met, I want to
know
whether or not, and how did she, was able to opt out her children?
Sure. Yeah, well, when United Opt Out started, I was connected to Seresta to do an interview on her on opting her daughter out. And Ro could probably speak to that more than I can because she's also in Florida where Seresta is. I don't know if you want to speak to that, Rosemarie, in terms of opting out in Florida.
I can. I mean, I think what you might be getting at, James, I know that, and Peggy, I could be wrong, but I believe Pennsylvania at the time had on its books a religious exemption to
gotcha.
The testing. I think that was probably one of the few states that did. Florida did not. We do not have a, there is no provision for, you know, legally parents opting out of the test. I mean, I think Seresta just went in and at the time knew that in order to graduate, because in our state you have to pass the reading portion of the 10th grade at the time. The 10th grade.
Florida.
Right,
Florida,
in Florida. Yeah, you have to pass supposedly the 10th grade reading FCAT in order to graduate. And Seresta knew from her own, you know, I think she'd be just reading through the law that you could take the ACT and have a concordant score. And so you didn't really need that Florida FCAT. So her, you know, she just told her, you know, told the school that her daughter wouldn't be taking it. She would be taking the ACT, and that would fulfill that requirement because that was on the books. That was on the books. You could take. You either had to pass the FCAT reading or have a. Originally, it was a 17 on the reading portion of the ACT, and then they recently, in the last couple of years, raised it to a 19 in order to graduate, and that's still on our books. So, you know, my son actually is a ninth. Well, he will be a 10th grader, and last year was ninth grade, and they ushered in the new FSAs. And I just went in and said he will not be taking. We will focus on the ACT. And thank you very much, but no thank you. And that's kind of what we did. So, you know, that may be an issue. And I have said for me, I can't, you know, claim this for anybody else, but as a parent of an ESC student, the only thing that this test assesses for me is his disability. It assesses right into his disability. So what does it tells me every year, yeah, he has a disability. And so therefore here's a child who goes to school every day, takes all the required courses, does extremely well day to day with accommodations, and you're going to deny him his diploma. You know, my husband and I are ready to go, you know, take this to court. Because I think at this point we need, because even if he can't do an ACT, which he may not be able to, his disability is such that, you know, it's right, you know, standardized testing, long standardized testing passages just really impact his disability. And so it doesn't show what he can do. It shows us what we can't do, and we already know what he can't do. So to deny him a diploma, that might be something. But there is no law on the books, none that I know of. So I think what Seresta and Opt Out provided parents was legal documentation of wording within, and Peggy, correct me if I'm wrong, the Constitution, that parents have the mm-hmm. right to direct their child's education ultimately. And so that language kind of, you know, gives a lot of us power to go in and say, look, we get to decide. You don't get to decide. We get to decide. So that's kind of, I think, where many of us in many states have kind of taken our power from. So
that's what I was looking for, but we can ask mm-hmm. Seresta now. She is no longer MIA.
Oh, good.
First, when I said MIA.
I'm here, Jane.
And also, Saressa has been on the show 4 or 5 times, so the rent provision is now invoked. And you've been on here enough times now that you can help pay the bills. Okay. The question was, before I mentioned the fact that, you know, you and Peggy met at an SOS meeting, and Peggy learned from you that you had used the opt-out provision for your child there in Florida. And so my question was, where did the opt-out provision come from, and how long has it been available that people didn't know about, and could any of you address that? And we've heard Rose Marie's answer. Can you add anything to that in terms of the history of we can opt out even though we didn't know that we could opt out?
Well, you know, opting out is not a new phenomenon. When you're talking about en masse like it's going on now, it is relatively new, but parents have always made the decision to opt their children out of testing that they thought was particularly damaging, possibly, and not necessary for their kid. In early 2000, you had quite a few parents that opted their students out of standardized testing. Even before, in the early 1900s, around 1927, when they started introducing standardized testing into public education, you had people that rejected it then, particularly the education community. Teachers fought vehemently against that. And so it's been around, and even before you're talking about American Shores, British school system in the 1700s. I mean, it's been there. It's something that's been there. We know its origin comes from eugenics, the fake science of eugenics, where people try to establish superiority racially and ethnically. So it's been around quite a bit. But what I refer to in terms of what's going on now is the most modern opt-out movement. And that certainly has come along with the advent of particular policy, No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, and Common Core State Standards. So when we look at the rejection of that particular policy, it kind of forms the new opt-out movement, so to speak.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was trying to learn about. But I also want to clarify one thing. I was not part of the first opt-out movement in 1927. Right? So that when you hear Peggy and Saressa talk about how old I am, I was not born yet. Okay, so now, however, I was part of the eugenics application in kindergarten. I was subjected to a IQ test. Mm-hmm. And I've talked about that on the show several times, and that I'm from Detroit, Michigan. We were one of the earlier northern states that desegregated our public facilities, including our schools. But we also had, as a standard procedure, all kindergartners were given an IQ test right out of the eugenics movement.
Wow.
And how you did on that test determined whether or not you stayed in the regular classroom or you were disappeared. And I talked about this on the show when I said disappeared. As a kid, we would go to school, you know, walk to school, and we would see people, and you would talk to the other students. And then when we got to building and entered the building, those kids disappeared. You did not see them for the rest of the day. You didn't see them until school was over and you guys were walking home together. There was an area on the top of the school, Detroit being a coal place. We had a brick building, 3-story, that they called the open air or the fresh air room. And I don't know, I can't remember whether that was the open air or the fresh air. We, the children, we were so fearful that we may land or end up on the 3rd floor in that room. Wow. It was really fearful that whatever happened that resulted in you being placed in that room and never seen again was a fear factor. I remember that to this day.
Wow.
So now we've got that history together. And it makes it even more courageous for those of you who started the United Opt-Out movement under the conditions that you did. And hence, that's why this show is called Profiles in Courage, United Opt-Out Striking in the Heart of the Privatization Beast. You leaders are truly courageous. Now let's talk about more about the movement itself. We know your motivation. What about your objective, your goals? I'll put it this way. We usually start out with your vision, which dictates your mission, which drives and establish your goals, and then your strategy. Let's go with that in order.
Well, I'm pulling up our website now. You know, if you go to our website, I want to read the top of it if I can get it up. We have our, more or less, our mission statement listed on there. So United Opt Out serves as a focus point of unyielding resistance to corporate ed reform. We demand an equitably funded, democratically based, anti-racist, desegregated public school system for all Americans that prepares students to exercise compassionate and critical decision-making with civic virtue. And then I'll hand it off to somebody else who wants to go next.
Saresta, you're in the schools right now. I mean, you... I mean, what would the vision be? I mean, I know what I mean, I can look at it as an elementary school teacher and as a parent, and I know what it, you know, again, it was never perfect prior to No Child Left Behind, not in any way, shape, or form. However, there was much more of a sense of autonomy among teachers within schools and with parents in the community to try to meet the needs of the kids within your school. And there was a much more broad and well-rounded education with, you know, more electives and more supports than even now. It's become so narrow and, you know, the schools are so defunded that, you know, we don't have the teachers don't have the supports they need for our ESE kids and our kids who are struggling and, you know, all kinds of things. Kids who are hungry and kids who have, you know, we just don't have the supports that the kids need that we had even when I was teaching. And I taught from 87 to 98. And we had lots of supports, a lot more than we did now. And so I think, you know, and I got to create the curriculum in my class. I knew what the standards were, where we needed kids to get to, but I had the freedom to do that, you know, with my colleagues. There's no freedom for that anymore. There's no, it's very rigid. And I knew how to assess students in very meaningful ways, and I could communicate that very well with my parents. And I think those are the kinds of things we're looking to bring back to schools and to have more of those supports, more guidance counselors, more reading specialists, more, social workers and psychologists and nurses and librarians and all the things that kids need to be successful. And we need more of it, not less of it. And, Saresta can talk about that as a teacher now in the system because I'm just looking at it from the outside, you know, with my children and what they're not getting. But I think we need more input and more, you know, our schools need to be very much a reflection of our neighborhoods, and we need to have, you know, more parent input and teacher input, and it's really not that way at all anymore. It's very much rigidly controlled all the way from the state level, all the way to your district level, all the way to the, you know, I sit in SAC meetings and I hear what the teachers are saying and I see what my kids are bringing home, and the teachers are very frustrated, you know, and the kids are too, because it's not a meaningful curriculum anymore. It's not child-centered. It's not about the relationship between teachers and kids. It's not any of those things. So I think that's kind of, at least from my perspective, what we are kind of striving for, you know, and we need to look at kids as whole human beings, not just STEM students or not just, what we've decided society needs. I mean, we have to look at what kids, you know, where their interests lie and where their talents lie and have a lot of offerings. We don't have things like wood shop, and we don't have things like, in high schools, you know, the kids used to be able to do medical internships while they were going to school. All these kinds of things have kind of gone away, and I think kids are, you know, don't have the choices and the well-rounded education that, they could be having, you know, because we're all vying for resources.
Let me interject.
Mm-hmm.
When I say the vision and mm-hmm. the mission,
right,
in truth, I'm talking about that age-old issue. What is the purpose of education or public education? Because it is the purpose. In the purpose is embedded your vision. And as I said before, embedded in your vision mm-hmm. is your mission. And from there, we follow all the way down to goals and strategies. I see what I thought was your purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I see what I thought was your mission.
Right.
And then your strategy and all. But I saw that because, like you, I'm a teacher. Like you, I'm a parent, now a grandparent. Like you, I see all the things that are being done to public ed that I don't want done and on. But I want to make sure that the public that we talk to on this show fully understand United Opt Out vision, because it starts there, and vision is really just another word for purpose. And there's a reason why I'm asking this question that I'll get to once we cover all the bases. So Peggy or Seresta, does either one of you have
sure.
anything to add to that?
Let me ask this, and I'm going to use Peggy's words that she used in Colorado to answer it. When we were there last in 2014, she was interviewed by a local television station there, and they asked, what is the objective here? Peggy was very succinct. We're going to shut down corporate every form. We're going to get rid of it. We're going to get rid of it. It's just that simple. And that is the objective, to get rid of corporate every form. And what are we going to replace it with? We want to have our schools that have their independent democratic voices. We want schools that are able to treat the whole child in a manner where they are learning to think critically, of course, and to blossom creatively, to have the type of pedagogy that is going to develop thinkers that can work to improve systems that are failing, systems that are not working in whatever arena. What we have now are students that are being taught to think a particular way, to respond to questions in a particular way, to think the same way as everyone else. When you're looking at the writing instruction that they're getting now, there's no ability to think on your own. There's an ability to learn how to parrot and plagiarize. This is the type of instruction these kids are receiving. And we want to put an end to all of that and make sure that the kids are able to develop according to their own self-interest, according to their community interest, and according to a world or global interest. We do not want to have kids that are trained to serve a corporate agenda and to become worker drones, that to have no ability to think, no ability to resist, no ability to change.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. You know, in addition to what they're both saying, I think it's really this simple. We want everything for all children. I mean, they deserve it all. It's really simple. I mean, you go to Sidwell, President Obama's children have everything for those children there. We want it for all children. And in addition to that, we want to make it really clear that the school cannot do this alone. So when we take down corporate education reform, we're going to demand everything for all children, and then we're going to do social policies to lift up communities to support these families that also want everything for their children. So it's a much bigger picture than just opting out of a test. It's really talking about what we can do, quite honestly, to save our democracy.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, because that's what I was trying to get at. In your book, you make all of those questions that I raised, your answer is very clear to those questions. However, I don't think the general public, beyond just the audience for this show, but the 300 plus, 315, 16 million people in this country and the 7 billion on the planet, they don't see the connection to the bigger picture that you guys just addressed, and particularly what you said, Peggy. In your book, you all do that, and I believe that one of the reasons for this show and the other shows that I'm going to do on the opt-out movement is that the public needs to know that we're not just talking about opting out of tests. We're not just talking about opting out of Common Core. There is a much more powerful message that the opt-out movement is all about, and it's that message that I want you guys, and I keep saying guys, you ladies, to bring out today and forever, that it's designed not just for what I just said, but also to bring about changes on a much larger scale. You mentioned it. I talk about it all the time, and that is the neoliberalism that has engulfed the political economy that movement is all about, has engulfed the entire world, and education is just one of those spheres that has been engulfed through privatization of what I say, everyone and everything on the planet. So thank you very, very much. Oh, and Peggy, in your book, your book, I wrote a note here that says, corp reform should be called for what it is, corporate takeover of public education. Mm-hmm. Don't refer to it as a reform anymore. Because, as I have said previously, we've gone through, six major reforms.
Right.
And the word reform, from going back to the beginning, was we want to make changes within the structure to make things better. Or when we were having conflict, we want to make changes in the structure so that our point of view of what the purpose of education should be. But the entire structure was never the target and was never at risk of being destroyed. That didn't come about until some say the 1930s, after the Great Depression there, some, and the installation of the New Deal with Roosevelt. Others say in the 1980s with Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, Augusto Pinochet in Chile, and Yao Ping in China, which was the ushering in of the neoliberalism philosophy, etc. I take it all the way back to the 1770s after the American Revolution. But the point is that the movement today is not a reform movement. It is very clear a movement that is designed to destroy public education and erect national privatization of education. That's my little rant. Sorry about that, folks. But let's move on to the other thing here, which brings us right back to the book. The book itself. I read the book. I've marked it up like crazy, as I always do. And I will say right off the top, I'm very prejudiced. I love the book. And so people, I have nothing but good things to say about the book. People, I urge everyone, every single parent, teacher, to get the book. And all friends of public education, the trillion of us who went through public school over the decades, we need to get the book. So now let's talk about the book. Why? Why the book and why now?
Well, why the book is because we really felt, you know, as I say in our introduction, that it was important to share a story and show what's possible. I mean, there were only six of us when this started, and we made something happen. We started something, and it grew grassroots, and we wanted to show the complexities of how this happens, but also research and evidence to show what works. And so I think it's a really complex book compared to a lot of other books out there, because we really kind of opened our heart and our soul in into this book and told a lot of truths. And again, that's one thing that causes United Opt Out to stay so strong, is because everything is about speaking the truth. We have no funding. We do this because it's the right thing to do. And we wanted to share that, you know, with everyone else to say, yes, you too can do this.
And I think so many people were very curious about everybody's stories who started this movement. You know, people, you know, were asking, you know, how did you get involved in this movement, and you know, where did your activism come from, and how did you get to this place? And so I think for everyone, I mean, I had very little, you know, contributions to the book, but I think, you know, going through the conversations that were happening as it was being written, that was really what came about, I think, for everybody. People were trying to answer those questions, not only for the people who asked them of us, but to clarify our own thoughts and our mission, just like you said, to really clarify that for us, too. So, I think now, because, you know, we're right, you know, now that 3 years in, everybody was very much, you know, kind of in a place where they felt comfortable to tell those stories. So,
Rosemary, let me just interject, and mm-hmm. I take exception to what you said earlier in terms of your minimal contribution. page 174, mm-hmm. I firmly believe that the decision to teach at a subconscious level, I disagree with that, is a choice to pursue social justice.
Mm-hmm.
That's a major, major contribution to this book and to the movement. My objection is, that for me,
right,
it was a very conscious decision. As I've said on the show, I started life, my mother wanted me to be a medical doctor, and I picked up that banner all my life until I got into my freshman year and started taking my pre-med courses and was bored as hell.
Oh.
And I'll say this. I remember sitting in one of my classes saying that a doctor sitting in the office looking at a patient, I don't want to spend the rest of my life looking down someone's throat and up someone's ass. There's more to what I want to do. There's more to what I need to do.
Right.
And that's when the next semester, I dropped out of the pre-med, never told my mother until very late several years later. And got into sociology and found my calling in sociology and psychology. It was because I wanted to help change the world. I wanted, my exact words were, I want to help make a better world.
Right.
Before I die, I want the sum of my efforts to contribute to making a better world for everyone. So, for me, when I read that statement, it was a major contribution. So, I differ with you in terms of your early remarks.
Okay.
One thing I want to add, Jane, to answer that question you asked, why the book? A while back, several years back, I was watching a program in which they were trying to determine what caused people to inflict pain or harm upon others. It was a test scenario where they had a person that had to send an electric shock to somebody they didn't know, but it was another human being. And as they were instructed to increase the intensity and pain, most people would do what they were told to do, regardless of the fact that it was hurting that other person on the other side of the wall. And they could hear the reaction of the people that were being inflicted with the pain. And this one astute person determined that it had nothing to do with man's empathy or ability to sympathize, or even personality or character traits, which is what we would think. Well, some people are just naturally nicer than others or treat others better. What he discovered is that those that had the skill set to be able to say, no, I'm not going to do it, were the ones that did not continue to inflict the pain. They had been taught, it had been modeled to them that they could say no, that they didn't have to do this. And my thoughts in going into writing that book was to provide a skill set for people to say no, you don't have to do it. Because a lot of people just don't have that skill set. They don't know how to reject it. And so for me, a lot of it was showing people what we went through, how we do it, what mistakes we made, what we did well with, and to provide a guideline. So more than just our little group would have a particular skill set they could draw from.
God, that's perfect, Saresta.
Yep,
that's really
that is.
Perfect. Yeah, because that is the hardest thing for people to get over. I mean, to really say, no, I'm not doing this, even though society's telling me I have to do it or I should do it. That's perfect.
Well, I have to agree, but it was my intent was to say no to everything that Saresta said today. Damn it, I have to agree with you.
You just can't do it, so don't try.
See, that's why I wanted to do it, because I knew he would come back. Okay. A question just came into me. I also have to say something, too. Like, Peggy and Saresta and I, we have a little family that we call ourselves the Fugitives. When we are together, it's silly time on my part mostly, and I crack them up, but we also make each other think and others think in the process of me being stupid or silly or however, a clean word I can say. But anyway, a question popped into me that says this, and it's sort of right into where we are in the conversation, is that what happened realistically to the child when parents opt out? Is there a consequence within the educational system? Is the child segregated in some way in the classroom or going forward? I'm going to take this question to mean two things. Maybe what happens during the process of opting out, which you guys know very, very well, and whether or not the person was asking, are there any long-term consequences? So very quickly, just give some short answers to that. I know you guys have written a book on this.
Well, that's a big question. It depends. It depends on the situation. That's what's so fascinating about opt-out is it depends on the child. It depends on the parents, the school, the district. In terms of what are the consequences, there can be some really bad consequences. Here in Colorado, we had students that were literally kept in rooms during their day and the phones, isolated by themselves in rooms, their phones taken away so they couldn't contact their parents. On the other side, you've got a child like Saresta's daughter who now knows how to advocate for herself and is able to go forth in this world and support others in making decisions and problem-solving as a citizen. So, long story short, a lot of things can happen.
Yeah, it depends on where you are and how the school responds. I mean, I've had situations, because now we're in the third school, where they were very supportive. I signed Connor in after the window, The testing window, so he did not have to sit and stare or sit and do nothing, or that didn't happen to him. But in some cases here in Florida, the opt-out Orlando, people do advocate kids go in and just sign in and sit and not answer any of the questions. So that can happen. You know, what happens for kids, you know, what's happening here in Florida, and real briefly, is kids who did take the test and didn't do well are being placed in remediation classes, are being denied certain electives because of that, whereas kids like my son who has no score, they can't do that. They have no score to base it on. They have to go by what's going on in his grade. So, you know, there can be consequences, yes. But ultimately, in a culture right now where everyone's talking parent choice, we want parents to have choices. When you go in and are very assertive about, no, you will not put my child in a remedial class, no, you will not, you know, make my child sit and stare, you know, you can be very assertive about that, and the school's, you know, it really depends on the school and your principal and how they feel about it. So there's really no hard and fast answer about that.
Exactly.
I have not had those experiences. Mine have been fairly...
Exactly.
Difficult.
But
yeah.
You know what, Ro?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to interject right quick. I think it's not so much on the school or the administrative staff. I think it's the parents. Certain parents are just not going to take it. And anybody that tries to tell them that their child's going to take the test, there's parents, and I'm a classic example, my child's not going to do it. And you're not going to do anything about it other than accept it. And I think it's a lot of times the attitude that the parent goes into this with that establishes how they're going to be dealt with or the response that they're going to get from that particular administrative staff or the district office. And because I know myself, my daughter, they were saying that she would have to go into that testing scenario and sit and stare. And I told them it's child abuse and I'll report it, and they left it alone. So I think a lot of it has to do with the parents' attitude as well. You do have situations where some students were told they couldn't attend this particular field trip or participate in this extracurricular activity. However, that is discrimination, and it's unfair discrimination, and parents do have recourse where they can file complaints at their district civil rights offices, et cetera. And we try to post all of that on our Facebook page for sure, what the recourses are if a parent is or a child is dealt with on a punitive level just because they are opting out of the testing.
Okay. Let's move to the last issue here, and that is your upcoming conference. I have to say, my Facebook group, when we put up the conference information, and then I guess I've mentioned it, I got a couple, 2, 3, 4 people who wrote some, I won't say negative things, or they expressed opinions. I think
be
you guys know where I'm going.
Really?
All right. I will be me. They basically say, no effing way would I ever attend a conference with some of the people that is going to be at this conference. I will disassociate now with United Opt Out. I understand and I appreciate United Opt Out, but I cannot attend a conference that a certain individual will be a part of. And then there was the one who said, and it's very appropriate to be on this site because that's the way Miller is and with his propaganda and et cetera. And I will say to you, the banner that we put out on the promotion, there was a question. Do you want to use this or do we want to use something less? I said, expletive, no. As long as we adhere to the motto, speaking truth to power with an attitude, and we believe in our truth, for those who don't want to, they don't have to come to the page, They don't have to come to the show. And for those who want to say very, very, very bad, negative words about me and the show, they can, and I won't say anymore. The upcoming conference. I understand it, and I totally am behind it. Tell the people about the upcoming conference. We got just a few minutes left.
Sure. Well, the title of the conference is Transcending Resistance, Igniting Revolution. You know, just like our book, which talks about the education revolution, our goal is to really help people see where this could be headed. And, you know, as we continue to say, we are hard left progressives. We want equity in the public schools. We want desegregated public schools. We want equitable funding, democratically based schools. And so it's, you know, when you opt out, we have a lot of people from various sides opting out. But once you've opted out after that, let's face facts. We're not going to be sitting at the same table together because we want certain things that other folks don't want. And so the truth is the conference was really set up to get our message as clear, crystal clear as we could. And so we chose our speakers very carefully. We chose our message very carefully. And we expected repercussions. And that's exactly what we got. But I think that the people that will be attending this conference will be on the side of us and wanting everything for all children. And we can make sure that when opt-out is done and we have taken down corporate education reform, we can be certain that there will be no charters, no vouchers, no segregation. Our goal is to get everything for all children, and I'm not so sure that everyone is on the same page as us. So our conference is trying to, I guess, really get clear what we stand for.
Therese?
Yeah, and I have to...
The elevator version, 30 seconds, 45 seconds.
I have to agree with Peggy. That's what we're trying to do. And we've discussed, this is not written in stone, so please don't take it written in stone, but we've discussed having a town hall for the Philadelphia and Camden, New Jersey community that Thursday before the actual conference starts. This is, nothing's written in stone, I'm going to say this again, but our goal is to not only preach to the choir, we want to come up with a whole skill set of strategies to reach out and extend beyond the choir. And with the particular thinkers that we will have at this particular event, I think we'll be able to do that, come up with serious game plans. But that is a hotbed of what can I say? It's been described as apartheid. When you're talking about Camden, New Jersey, and Philadelphia, when you're talking Philly, remember, they were the school system that, what was it, 2 years ago? They had no money to pay teachers, no money to open schools. It, you know, it's ground zero when you really think about it. So I think that community that lives there is ripe for the picking when it comes to learning how they can really reclaim their public education.
Rose, let's bring Rose in. And Rose, you have 30 seconds.
30 seconds. I cannot wait. You know what? I love these conferences for the reason that they have always picked people that have pushed people's thinking and pushed people to be uncomfortable and to challenge, our own paradigms, the ones that we have, you know, become very complacent about. And so for me, I think this is exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to push people's thinking and get people talking and really get people to, you know, really empower people out in the communities there and to take it back to wherever they're coming from, if not the local communities, to impact change. We really need to reclaim our public schools.
Okay, that's it. Now, we're going to do a part two to this, but not next week. We're going to have some of the other founders on, and we'll go through some of the same process. Next week, there's going to be a special show that came about as a result of something that happened here in Los Angeles this past Friday, and that is the group of Charter School Alliance here went to the board, the Waltons. Mm-hmm. They went to Eli Board Road. Mm-hmm. And they were going to go to L.A. Unified with a plan to double the number of charter schools here in Los Angeles from 100-plus to over 200. California is perhaps one of the real friendly state to privatization of everything here. There's a group of us who are opposed to the privatization of public education that are trying to get an initiative put on the ballot for this coming presidential election to repeal all of the charter school legislation, to get rid of charter schools. So that's going to be the show for next week, and then we'll come back to opt out either the following week or the week after that. But with that, I have to say goodbye. It has been fantastic, ladies. We're definitely going to get together over the next few weeks, months, talking about opt-out on our way up to the conference. So, for everyone, thanks for listening, and hopefully you'll come back next week.